Thank you for downloading the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. We are covering the Twin Peaks television series. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
If you want to support this podcast, the number one thing you can do is to open up iTunes and write us a review. Or click some stars if you were shy. You can also write in feedback. Our feedback section is the meat of this podcast, so consider being a part of it. You can reach us by going to our website at noship.net. You can click on our contact page, which will lead you to the various means you can communicate with us, such as Facebook, Twitter, and our Gmail account.
And we also have an Amazon link. That's an easy way to help support us, too. You just click on the link. It takes you to the Amazon homepage, and then you can do your shopping like normal. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but it helps us out to pay for such goodies as pie and coffee and
bandwidth.
That being the more important thing.
Right. So before we get into recap, do you have a PSA for us today?
For the remainder of the episode, for your safety and ours, please stay on the bike. We are recapping Season 2, Episode 9, entitled Arbitrary Law. This one was written by Mark Frost, Harley Payton, and Robert Engels, had three writers on this one, and directed by Tim Hunter. Do you have anything you'd like to say about this before we get started?
I just was not as into this episode as I was in the past, but not that I didn't like it,
right.
Overall. I don't know if it's because of the camera angles were brought to my attention by some of our feedback, and I was really paying attention to that. I have something else to add to that discussion too, but we'll just go ahead and get a recap, and it'll surface as we talk.
Okay. I like the episode. There's certain parts that I really like, and then other parts that fall somewhat flat. I kind of get that Wizard of Oz, man behind the curtain feeling, and certain things where you feel like you're seeing into the process of it, and it comes up a little bit lacking. But that's not to say that I'm down on this episode at all. But let's get into recap, like you said, and we'll go from there. All right. The episode starts with a quick shot of Maddie, still dead, still wrapped in plastic. Then we get a really cool shot of the Four Horsemen of Twin Peaks. And although the background music is cool enough, I can't help but think of The Boys Are Back in Town by Thin Lizzy. I mean, that would be excellent, just played on top of this.
Of course, it's not really like this exciting thing like that song is implying. There was a body that just washed up because they failed to catch the killer.
True, but these are like the four badasses that they're going to figure it out. You know, they're walking into town. Or maybe like that movie, The Right Stuff, with all the astronauts walking down the, you know, they had that 5-minute shot that's kind of an icon in American movie history now, I guess. I don't know. Is that a good movie or not? I might be talking out my ass here. I know the shot's iconographic, but I don't know if the movie's good enough to really put up there, so we'll just move on. The pace is set with a no-nonsense briskness, starting with Albert filling Coop and Truman in about the fur evidence and the letter O found under Maddie's ring fingernail. Truman wants to get Maddie's contact info from Leland to inform her family, but Cooper has a request. 24 hours to, quote, finish this. Albert pulls him aside, and instead of giving him grief about his unorthodox methods, he tells him to go with his gut and get this monster before he takes another bite. And Cooper doesn't know where to start, but Hawk gives him a Yoda pep talk, and off he goes. Just follow the path. Do you think it's weird? What I liked about this scene was the fact that Albert wasn't giving him a whole load of crap about his unorthodox methods and saying, Coop, you know, this isn't about a dwarf. It's not about a giant. It's not about this, that, and the other thing or whatever dream you had. He kind of just says, whatever you got right now, just go with it. Get this done.
I guess Albert's always functioned as that voice of reason. And so in a way, he's still being that voice, but even though it doesn't sound like it.
If you think about it, though, their methods haven't worked. Everything else they've tried has failed, and this guy is killed again. So, I mean, maybe Albert's just going, well, crap, you know, I'm pragmatic above all, so do what you got to do to get this done.
It's a Hail Mary pass.
Yeah. All right, next scene. Donna waits for James at the Double R, and after a short conversation, he gives her a ring. Do you think this is a promise ring, or this is an engagement ring, or this is a I'm going to skip town the first time we hit a speed bump ring, or what is it?
It's a reminder of rings in general.
For one, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like an engagement ring. I don't really know. Mm. It's interesting how she's, I know she's wearing a pink sweater, but it looks red, and the tablecloth is red, and they purposely put red things near her, like the ketchup bottle and a Solo cup.
I think that's a coffee cup. I think, because what I had was, I said, the scene has a lot of red in it, from the pink of Donna's sweater to the tablecloth to the seat backs, the coffee cups, and the ketchup squirter. See, I wrote coffee cup, so it has to be a coffee cup.
You must be right. Why would she have a solo cup in there? So you're probably right.
Well, I remember earlier in the, I think it was in season one, when they show cups at the double R, they're shaped exactly like that one.
Okay.
They're that weird, like, V shape, you know, with the little handle on them and everything.
And the white lip.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting because obviously they're alluding to the red curtains when you see Donna there. And I think they're trying to subconsciously get you to think, oh, she could be the next victim by associating her with that. And then you've got James giving her that ring. He gave Laura a necklace in the past. And, you know, that's.
So we're being set up for a red herring.
Yes.
Kind of, in a way. I mean, it fits with, you know, what else happens in the episode, really. You know, so. Yeah, I actually didn't think that. I had on my notes, I said, are we to interpret this as love? Is this somehow a Lodge reference, which I think is obvious, but is red in Twin Peaks somehow a signifier of danger, like the light, Sparkwood in 21? I don't know, but. Anyway, then we have a short exchange between Norma and her raging bitch of a mother, letting us know that it was always specifically her that her mom was always disappointed in. God, I can't stand that lady.
It's interesting. We didn't talk about the camera angles at the opening of this episode, but which were askew. And the camera angles in this scene, you have Norma looming over her mother. And which is of a power position, but she's clearly not in the power position. So, because she's
the one being berated, and she's the one who's kind of vying for her mother's approval.
Right.
So you wouldn't tend to associate that with a power position. But if you do look at the angles, which are weird throughout this whole episode, and I was going to talk about that later on in the feedback section, because we actually have, I think, both of our pieces of feedback address that.
Do they address this scene?
No. Just the angles in general and the mechanics of the episode. But you're right. It shows you get to see her mother from an above angle, which is weird, you know, because you're just not used to seeing that kind of angle in Double R.
Yeah, the camera angles put Norma in the power position, but her mother's clearly getting under her skin. So in reality, or at least emotionally speaking, that's not the truth there, right?
So it's a weird kind of artsy play, I guess, is what they're doing with the camera angles. I can't quite figure it out, because you're absolutely right, because even when they're looking up at Norma, you're looking up at Norma, so she's looking at her from the seating position. Maybe it's an exaggeration of the actual physical differences between them, one standing and one sitting. I don't know
why.
Yeah, I can't figure that out. Deputy Andy sits alone eating pie and trying with considerable difficulty to say, I am a lonely soul, en français. Donna and James are passing by and hear him, and Donna kind of beats it out of him where he had heard this from. He lets them know it was on Harold's suicide note, and then they are off to find Cooper. Of course, Andy keeps repeating the line because he's talking about himself as well.
You think so?
I think so. I think he's kind of shooken up about the fact that, you know, he's estranged from Lucy and she's pregnant, and his sperms, as he likes to call them, weren't.
But he's a whole damn town now. He's not lonely.
Yeah, but he knows that. I don't know. I think he has an inkling before the ball actually drops that, you know. I don't know. I think call it Andy's intuition. But Donna does kind of freak out on him a little bit. She's just like, where did you hear that from? Where did you hear that from? He's just, Andy's not equipped to have these kind of social interactions.
Yeah, but you would flip too.
Probably, yeah.
You had that weird experience with the magician boy.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think Andy was going with them, because they kind of just walk out, her and Donna, out of the double R. But apparently Donna, Coop, and Andy, you know, I guess we just dropped James at some point.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah. Donna, Coop, and Andy are at the Tremont's residence, and Donna lets Cooper know that the grandson said the same words to her that were on the suicide note. Now, as an aside, have they always pronounced it Tremond?
No.
Because they do in this episode, and they do it repeatedly, but I'm pretty sure that before this they've said Tremond.
Yeah.
And that's the way to pronounce it, but now it's Tremond. Okay. Anyway, at the door is not an elderly woman, but a middle-aged one with no grandsons and no idea what Donna is on about. But she does have a letter that was found in her mail addressed to Donna from the morning after Harold died. So they take it and read it. And, of course, this is a letter that is a torn page from Laura's diary detailing the events from the Laura/Cooper dream of the Red Room, which this basically describes her side of it. And we find out kind of what was whispered into Cooper's ear, which to the effect that Bob is only afraid of one person, and that's Mike. We get a close-up of Donna's red lips as she reads this. Laura goes on to say that she knew she was going to die and that this was the only way that Bob could no longer hurt her. Was Bob planning to take over her body next? Cooper lets them know that they had the same dream, and Andy has to take Donna home. So, you know, this is where he says, that's impossible, you know.
Why do you think Harold selected that particular page? Do you think he was instructed by Laura to do that, to give that to Donna to make sure? I mean, why would he wait till his death?
This would imply to me that he knows more, or he knew more about everything that was going on than he ever let on. And he had to know that this particular page would have some import if read out loud to Cooper. But he didn't know who Cooper was. But, you know, as far as we know, I mean, that's the only thing I can think of, is that he was in on more of the mystery than we've been previously led to believe.
If it even was him, it could have been the Tremonds or Chalfons, whoever they are.
True. Or the Tremonds.
Yeah. Well, here's an idea. Maybe the Tremonds not necessarily didn't want Donna to find it, but wanted Cooper to find it. Because the idea has been put forth that they're guides leading people to the Black Lodge to have that judgment, or the White Lodge.
Hmm.
And maybe this whole scenario is a trap specifically set up for Cooper. It's just an idea. It doesn't mean that's what it is.
It would make sense, though, if you think about it, because Harold had this piece of the diary the whole time, and the rest of the diary got shredded, right?
Right.
So this is the only surviving part of Laura Palmer's secret diary, and it's in the safekeeping of the Tremonds, who, through this lady who is actually a real Tremond, I guess, in the real world, she's the one who gives it to Donna, because I guess Harold figured out that Donna would show up with Cooper at some point. But it's important that it gets to Cooper is the main thing.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I think the whole point was for it to get to Cooper.
Yeah, because it's detailing Laura's dream. So, and then somebody along the way had to know that Cooper had the same dream, and it had to get into his hands so all of the pieces could fall into place. So, you know, we were asked in feedback about how, like, doesn't it seem convenient that, you know, he figured it all out now during sweeps week, but maybe this was the catalyst. This was the one thing that could set it off.
And it would also make sense why the Tremonds revealed themselves to Donna, because that's the only person it doesn't make sense that they revealed themselves to is her, if they are acting as guides.
Yeah, that would kind of come around the other side and give us a reason for that, like in the back of it.
Yeah, because she's sleuthing on her own, and her findings would eventually reach Cooper. And I thought about it just to make it kind of funny, because why would they be going after Cooper? You know, what would be so important about Cooper? And you know, I just decided to kind of make it analogous to Dune. Like, he's like the Kwisatz Haderach of finds, you know, for them. Like, his body, his host body maybe, is the one they want. And like, Laura was like the Count Fenrig. She just didn't quite pan out, so they're going for plan
the
B.
The failed Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah.
Dune fans will get that. Yes. I'm not explaining it.
Yes.
That's a good way to look at it. I mean, think of it. I mean, just think of it from like a conquering aspect. I mean, to get Agent Cooper, this guy that has such moral, you know, fortitude and fiber, to be able to get him as a host for anybody, whether it's Bob, Mike, or the Giant, or somebody else, that'd be a good pull. You know, that'd be kind of like you know, when people say like, oh yeah, she's out of your, what do they say? She's out of your class. Or
out of your league?
Out of your league. That's it. Thank you. Yeah. He's out of everybody's league. So to kind of get him would be a big win, a big score.
Yeah, because I think it's more than just Bob. And Jubel, who had written it to us before, had talked about all these smaller pieces being a larger whole, all these different entities. And I'll talk more about it when we get to Leland's confession.
Meanwhile, at the Great Northern, Gerard is in one of the rooms on the edge of death, with Doc Hayward wanting to give him the drug, but Cooper holding it back, of course, so they can talk to Mike and not Gerard. Cooper tells him that Bob has killed again and that he was part of his dream. Mike answers with a monologue about when him and Bob would kill together, that they had a perfect relationship, appetite, satisfaction, a golden circle, the ring. Coop remembers giving his ring to the giant, who can help him find Bob if he can find the answer in his heart. So I'm feeling like this is where the episode really starts to get like they're pushing things towards a sort of finale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're reminded of all these things that have happened in the past, and it's getting pushed to the forefront. Like, okay, here we go. It's remember this, remember that. Now it's all coming together.
First of all, Al Strobel could play a pirate. Second of all, this corroborates what Daniel was saying about why Mike / Philip Gerard acts the way he does, because he's been without his medication. Because Doc Hayward seems to think that he needs his medication to help him get well. When he says to Cooper, you know, you need to listen to your heart instead of your brain, it just points to the fact that Cooper has been off this path for a little while. That's why he's been led astray away from solving, because he hasn't been listening, what I refer to as the denizens, but at some point, I guess he quit listening to them and started listening to evidence instead. And
yeah, well, it's kind of like he got pushed off his path because he, like you said, he started looking at hard evidence, but that started pushing him towards Ben Horn, which is the ultimate red herring
mm-hmm.
of the series. And that's exactly what Bob wanted. So now all of the Desinans, as you call them, are trying to tell him, okay, switch, you know what I mean? Switch from the head to the heart, go with your gut, and you're going to find the answer. Which it's true, you know, so he's kind of like going back to basics, going back to the beginning. I feel like this episode desperately wanted to be written in season one, that, you know, whoever was writing it, it's like they were just pining away for those times when everything was still the way it was in season one, and that kind of Cooper and that kind of putting together these magical hints and things like that. I mean, I could be being a little harsh, but that's how it feels. So anyway, Cooper sees the elderly waiter in the hallway who lets him know that the cooling milk is getting warmer. In Ben Horn's office, everything seems to be falling into place, perhaps a little bit too easy. The stuffed fox, the telephone records, the time of Maddie's death, everything fits.
It's exciting, Harry, though.
Oh, yeah. This is just like setting bells and whistles off in his policeman's brain because it's kind of like going, yes, yes. It reminds me of when I was a little kid and I would do multiplication tables, which I was like horrible at. But then when I'd get like two or three in a row, you know, that like, and I'd got them, I was just like, yeah, and they would be the simple ones. It would be like 2 times 4, 3 times 7 or whatever. And I'd just be patting myself on the back. You know, it's too easy, Harry. Come on, you know. But Cooper stares at the fox distractedly the whole time as Truman and Albert give their evidence, as if something else altogether is running through his mind. And in the background, I guess they're just dismantling all of the possessions in Ben Horn's office because they take a big, it's either a swordfish or a sailfish. I always get them mixed up, like right past the screen. Two guys are carrying it out. Like that could possibly be a piece of evidence that would have some bearing on this case.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what kind of fish it is.
It's one of the two. It's a swordfish or a sailfish. It's one of the, I think it's a sailfish. I want to say it's a sailfish. Anyway, anything to say about this scene?
Yeah, I mean, he's starting to listen to his heart, as Mike suggested, and he's kind of letting Harry still run with his...
It's almost like he hatches a plan at this point. Like, I'm going to let Harry run with the whole idea that this is Ben Horn while I'm zeroing in on the real killer, and I won't tell him till the last second.
Harry's just background noise right now. He works toward it.
But he does, you're right, though. He does seem like an excited child.
Yeah.
We have a quick scene between Andy and Lucy at the office about the paternity of the baby. Andy calls Dick and lets him know that he needs to talk. But he kind of backs down a little bit. You know, he's like, well, you know, if you have time.
To Lucy's disappointment.
Lucy looks very disappointed about that. But it's, I'm not on Lucy's side for any of this anyway. So I'm definitely team Andy if we're printing up shirts at some point. But here we have a really good scene. Ben Horn is visited by Tajamora in his cell. Catherine toys with him for a bit about the $5 million check, you know, still playing as the Japanese businessman. She reveals her foot, which Ben recognizes pretty quickly as Catherine's, and he gets excited. He's just like, oh, now that you're alive and everything, you can tell Truman about our night together so I can have an alibi. So in exchange for this alibi, he has to sign over all the rights to the mill and the Ghostwood Estates, which he does in a heartbeat. And then she kind of pulls back a little bit, and he's like, you're going to tell him, right? And she's like, oh, you know, it's within the realm of possibility. I'll consider it. So a pretty good snap by Catherine. coupled with some of the stuff that she said.
I liked how she asked him a couple of questions first before she revealed who she was. She was seeing how she had a, her tape had affected him, and if he was going to try to like play some more games with this Tajimura fellow, you know. So
Yeah.
I thought that was cool.
I had forgot about that because I mean that was only last episode or the episode before, but it was yeah, that is pretty cool. She's devious.
Yeah,
She's
she's
definitely.
smartest person in town for sure.
She doesn't always come out on top, but you're beating pretty much everybody in the game right now. This here's where it starts to get a little dark. But Donna visits Leland, and she wants him to mail a tape with the musical butchery that the three of them had participated in to Maddie. And of course, Leland's like, "Oh, sure. I remember her telling me about this. She'll be so excited to get this," and blah blah blah. And Leland notes that the sunglasses she's wearing look familiar. They were Laura's, and Maddie had given them to her, to Donna. And so now Donna lights up a cigarette. Here we go. She's about to do something stupid and reckless and crazy, and she lights up a cigarette. After she does it, she proceeds to tell Leland that the cops found Laura's secret diary at Harold's apartment. And Bob is pretty surprised by this. He's just like, "No, I didn't know. I mean,
Do you want some lemonade?
yeah, do you want?" I wouldn't expect Donna to realize that Leland was possessed by Bob, but just the look on his face, the way his features contort when he hears certain pieces of information is just, it's creepy.
Why isn't Donna acting sultry since she's got those glasses on?
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. I guess seducing Leland Palmer wasn't in the playbook this afternoon. But I mean, she is lighting up the cigarette, so
Yeah.
that's kind of her Laura-esque stuff. But so right after she lets him know about the secret diary, he moves in. Like he's about to get close to her, and then the phone rings. And of course, this is Maddie's mom wanting to know where she is. And this kind of sets Donna's nerves on edge because she can tell that something's wrong. And he says, "Yeah, it's the strangest thing. Maddie never made it home." So Donna's looking worried, and Leland, in all his infinite sense, tells her, "I'm gonna go get you some lemonade. That's just the thing." So he comes back with what is clearly not lemonade, whether it's orange juice, grapefruit juice, or just whatever
Poison
kind,
juice.
poison juice they had in the fridge is anyone
Sleepy juice.
sleepy juice. It's a Barney special. But
See,
I would have left.
if this was filmed nowadays, it would be great if we had a webisode to where you see Leland go get the lemonade and he discovers there's only orange juice in there. And you know it's Bob, really. And it's just to see the confusion and the whatever. I'll give her orange juice.
His gray hair is just like shaking around because his head keeps flipping side to side, and he's like, "What? Wait a minute. What do I?"
Said lemonade.
So he gives this to her and puts a record on and then wants to start her dancing. Now, at this point, anybody's like creepometer's got to be going off in their head.
Yeah, but this is Leland who, you know, she's grown up with her best friend's dad, her dad's friend, and you know, she's I think still being polite at this point.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I just looking from the outside in, it just seems like really creepy.
It is. It is creepy.
Bob begins his dance with Donna, and thunder rolls in the distance, and he gets ready to do his thing as Donna is saved by the bell. With Truman needs Leland's help with another murder, and he needs him to come right away.
Well, he grips Donna tightly and pulls her to his chest.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's and he starts to smell her hair and neck, right?
Yeah, he's doing something creepy like that, and it's just in a guy of that age and a girl of that age, there's the father and daughter dynamic, so you're bringing back the whole domestic violence thing back into it, and it really hits home again how horrible of a murder, that Laura's was and Maddie's. So, oof. But there's going to be some more on that in the feedback section because I want to compare this episode to Fire Walk With Me, but I want to kind of do it in the context of what our listeners have wrote in. So Donna, he doesn't even when he leaves to go with Truman, he doesn't even say like goodbye to Donna or anything like that. He just goes. So Donna walks away, and I guess she's just like walking aimlessly through the. Somehow she got in touch with James, and he's meeting her there. I don't know if this was already set up or something, but she's sitting at a bench near the water in the woods, and James pulls up and starts talking to her, and he's happy at first, but then he kind of. She lets him know that Maddie's dead, and he gets real pissy real quick.
Well, she knows without anybody actually specifically telling her that the body's Maddie. I think probably because of her experience at the Roadhouse, and so she's someone who has like a special gift too. Who knows? I don't know, but she just knows it's Maddie. And when she's walking up to that area where they meet, and she's crying as she's walking, that makes me choke up a little bit every time I see that. She does a really good job. And then she meets with James, and I said when we were watching this that I felt really bad for Laura Flynn Boyle, because I feel like she's really putting it all out there with her acting, and he's not totally delivering very well. At least at the beginning he was, and I think he did a little bit better toward the end of the scene. But yeah, his reaction to Maddie being murdered is not, you think there'd be a little bit more grief. He's just like, fuck this shit, man. I hate this town. I'm leaving.
Well, he's like, this is not good. And obviously, a dead friend, I mean, when is that ever good?
I know.
So she's like, do you mean us? And he won't commit to anything, and he just kind of gets petulant about it. So, this all takes place inside of a day. So maybe 2 hours ago, at the most, he was more or less proposing marriage to her. And now, because Maddie's dead, he's gonna leave. He freaks out and leaves, telling her that it doesn't matter if they're happy, or what does it matter if they're happy if the world is still going to hell, which is a horrible, horrible philosophy when you think about it. Because you're basically saying, I'm going to forsake my own happiness because the world is still going to be a shitty place even if I'm happy. So now the world's not happy and you're not happy. Don't you think you should try to get at least one out of two?
It just makes me glad that I'm past the overdramatics of teenage years, because it's just really over the top
Is. It is.
reaction to.
Then he rides off into one of the worst subplots the world has ever seen. So.
Yeah, that's something to look forward to. Yeah, I but what you were asking earlier, I do agree. There is might as well create happiness where you can. Why throw away a chance at happiness just because you don't like the world around you?
I mean, it really they're keeping him consistent because he's so morose and so down all the time, and he's just like, this hard luck case and all this other stuff. But it's a horrible philosophy when you really peel it back and look at it, because you're just going, wait a minute, did you just say what I think you said? That doesn't make any sense. So a storm is brewing. Ben sits alone at a table cracking peanuts, and as Cooper and Albert watch from the bar, they're at the Roadhouse here. Truman and Leland arrive, and Leland wants to know if the killer is meeting them there, which is a really weird question, and it doesn't make any sense coming from Leland, but it makes perfect sense coming from Bob.
It does, because he wants to know what they know.
Exactly. Because, if you think about it, I mean, really, Cooper had to know right then and there, because why would a lawyer and an intelligent man like Leland Palmer ask that question? That doesn't make any sense. If I knew the killer was on the way, I would just have him arrested wherever he's at, But anyway, Ed shows up and Cooper asks for the room to be cleared. Hail, hail, the gang's all here, as Hawk wheels in Leo followed by Bobby. So we have this,
Bobby
like,
being a punk too.
oh yeah, telling Hawk to give himself a raise, and
And the way he wheels Leo through the room.
yeah, his last little act of petulance. Because Cooper doesn't want to have anything to do with it. He's just like, Bobby, wheel him over there and be quiet, if you know what I mean. Which is another callback to their first interaction when he's like, this is how this works. We ask the questions and you answer them quickly and to the point. So I feel like they're trying to force a feeling of the older era of Twin Peaks into this episode. Here we have a bunch of people in this room and we really don't get an explanation why they're here. But they're characters that haven't had a whole lot of play on screen, or, about half of them are characters who haven't had a whole lot of play on screen for the last several episodes. I mean, I don't remember the last time I saw Major Briggs
I
before
know.
this, and Bobby's been basically relegated to trying to get one over on the guy across the room that they're about to take to jail, And then Ed, he's been absent for the last couple episodes as well. So it's like they're bringing all these people in, but you just don't know. Like, what's going on here? But anyway, Cooper tells the crowd about how he has gone about solving Laura's murder up until this point and all of the methods he's employed. As the skepticism builds, he notes that someone is missing, and as the clock strikes three and the thunder strikes as well, Major Briggs enters escorting the elderly waiter. The Giant's host offers Coop some gum. That gum you like is coming back in style. Another callback. And then everyone is frozen in a flash of lightning. Okay, and then Cooper finally reveals to the audience, at least, what Laura told him, that her father killed her. That's what she was whispering in his ear. And it's just now that he's able to realize it. And the giant appears and drops the ring. Cooper picks it up, and he looks at it contemplatively for a minute, and then he asks Ben Horn to accompany him to the sheriff's station with Leland as his attorney. Leaving, he gives a thumbs up to the waiter who salutes him back.
Because for some reason he knew that Bob would behave that way. So they had to pull one over on Bob. They couldn't just arrest Leland. Like, somehow he knew that's how they had to handle, even though they can pretty much handle Mike / Philip Gerard pretty well.
But
physically,
he's ostensibly a quote-unquote good spirit, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or at least not actively on the side of chaotic mischief all the time. So it would be easier to control him, because you wouldn't have this person who's probably going to try to kill you if you had Bob. And then there's no evidence to arrest Leland at this point. They have to get that confession. So to try to arrest him would be, you know, number one, it would be illegal, because they don't have anything to do it on. There's no grounds to do it on. So that's what I'm thinking anyway.
Yeah, you're right.
But it also heightens the dramatic tension in the episode mm-hmm. to have all this going on at one point. So at the police station, making sure that Leland is comfortable with the situation, that, you know, he's like, they have their little talk. He's like, okay, well, I'm going to start bail proceedings as soon as possible. Cooper whispers in Harry's ear. Then they pull the old rope-a-dope and push Leland into the cell. Bob comes out right away and starts thrashing around the cell, yelling at the top of his lungs. Just going crazy. They get a confession out of him, which is a whooping for a little while, and then he just says yes. And then they ask him if he also killed Maddie, and he says, what do you think? And then they go back and forth for a little while. So basically they've gotten the confession out of him that he did it, and that's enough for Truman. And they leave him in the cell by himself. But before that, all I had written was that Ray Wise does the acting of a lifetime here, ranting as Bob, letting Cooper know that he knows about what happened in Pittsburgh, which takes him, you know, aback. He's
right.
Like really surprised. And you could see,
because he brought up a knife.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. A little bit of surprise registers on Albert's face, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's usually pretty skeptical about this stuff. And Bob, you know, Bob more or less lets them know that Leland has a hole where his conscience used to be, which is that's a pretty gruesome way to put that. I mean.
And he's going to pull a ripcord, and he's going to learn everything, only for a moment. When Cooper whispered into Harry's ear, I wondered how much Harry had already known before that, because it didn't take a lot of words for Cooper to convey, like, what's going to happen, that Leland's the killer. And then, you know, the look on Truman's face is not of surprise. It's more of like, oh, okay.
It's almost like he's just going, he's following Cooper's lead.
Yeah.
You know, it does make you wonder how much he does know. But I mean, yeah. It's. So
he had to have been prepped for that, because he's, you know, so convinced that Ben's the killer. And then to, you know, oh, we're throwing him into the room?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, isn't that kind of illegal?
It could be that he's just going to go and just trust what Cooper is trying to do, and then just see how it comes out in the end. Because even when they do throw him in the cell, he's like, we're going to need more evidence than this. And he's like, how about a confession, Harry? So this is where some of the pacing issues that I mentioned in an email to Joel, because we wrote a little bit back and forth about this, kind of come into play, because Dick shows up at the station and he has a sit down with Lucy and Andy, and she lets them know that she's going to keep the baby and that there will be a blood test when it's born. And Dick lights up a cigarette after he asks Andy for a light, which was a dickhead move to do. You know, because Andy's like looking around for a light, you know, and then he's like, wait a minute, why am I going to give you a light? You're my rival, you know, and he just kind of laughs disdainfully at him. So he lights his cigarette and the smoke just starts drifting up towards the smoke detector.
Mm-hmm.
And then back down in the basement, Albert lights up as Cooper explains right in front of a no smoking sign that's painted on the wall. When Cooper explains how Ben's blood type was not a match and how the answer was right in front of him the whole time, the clues all start to come together and make sense. The gray-haired man, the dancing man, Robertson, son of Robert, the letters under the fingernails, etc. Bob is ranting and raving in the other room, and he kind of gives a verbal encapsulation of everything that Bob has said up until this point that we know about. He gives the firewalk with me speech about the magician. He talks about the death bag and how he everyone thinks he's insane, but he will kill again. The sprinkler system goes off, and Bob goes haywire, slamming his head into the door. Bob flees, and Leland comes back, only to come face to face with what he has done. So now they're in the room with him, and he explains how they controlled him since he was a child, and how he had no choice, and how they made him kill Laura, and when she was getting too strong to get to. As Leland dies, Cooper tells him to follow the clear light into the cloudless void without circumference or center. Leland expires as the rain stops and he sees Laura.
What is it about the water, like the sprinkler system going off, that triggered Bob to be like, okay, this is now the time that I'm going to release myself from Leland's body? Is it a way that he transfers himself through water out of the body? Does he travel on it, or it just seemed like a good chaotic moment to take advantage of?
That's what I think. Yeah, I think it's because there hasn't been anything about water in their lore beforehand.
Right,
this.
There hasn't.
So I think it's just taking advantage of some sort of general chaos that's going on.
And then, you know, it mostly makes sense that Leland would be really sad about Laura, right? But mm-hmm. No mention of Maddie. Whatsoever. He killed Maddie too.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
And, you know, we saw how he related to Maddie. They seemed to love her almost as much as they loved Laura, you know, and there's just no mention of her.
Hmm.
Maddie's chopped liver.
I guess so. Well, there is something that I mentioned that when we get to feedback room, I wanted to talk about the difference between this episode and Fire Walk With Me and stuff. And there might be a little bit of something in there that I could kind of relate back to this, but okay. We'll see. But you're right, though. I hadn't thought about it until now. Now, just now thinking about the whole thing all at once, it was like, well, it could be that, but I hadn't really thought too much about the fact that he doesn't even mention Maddie.
Another thing I want to point out about Leland's confession is he uses the pronoun they instead of he when he's talking about...
Yeah, he uses it several times.
He's not putting the blame on Bob. He keeps saying they made me.
They wanted me. They made me kill Teresa Banks.
Yes.
They made me do this and that. They made me kill Laura when they figured out that they couldn't have her.
That's very interesting.
I really don't know what to make of this because I got the, you know, when we talk about Fire Walk With Me and everything that went on in that, it's, I think we brought this up before, maybe in this actual episode, that there's a difference between Mark Frost and cohorts writing this episode of Twin Peaks and what David Lynch did with Fire Walk With Me. But when he did it, there was a whole bunch of people in the room. You know, there was Jürgen Prochnow doing the, like, lifting his arm up and down. There was Mike. There was Bob. There was the little kid with the cream corn who was, I don't know if he was supposed to be the Tremont's grandson kind of thing, or if that was the same kid or
it
not.
Is.
It is. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Cool. So he's there as well. So there's a bunch of players in the room at the time, but they all seem to be chastising Bob for what he's done. So that would kind of lead me to believe that there was this consensus that what he did wasn't necessarily in the best judgment of everybody else in the lodge at the time. But here we have Leland under Mark Frost's tutelage kind of saying, they made me do it. So what do we make of that? I mean, I don't know if there's any real, like, solid answer for that question. It's great for speculation, but I mean, I don't know. I'm drawing a blank on that.
Yeah, I'd like to hear some feedback on that.
Because it really kind of points in the direction of there being a general consensus among the denizens of the lodge on what to do and when to do it. But then you see that there's this dissension later on when Laura was killed. So it wouldn't, I don't know if it's a contradiction per se, because who can know the mind of these things? You know, these creatures or these spirits.
Yeah, write in and let us know your thoughts. You guys are definitely smarter than us about this stuff.
Yeah, way more insightful too. Man. But this is like the best acting that's done in the whole series, I think,
mm-hmm.
by everybody who's involved in this scene. Well, you know, Leland and Cooper, really.
Yeah, Cooper does a good job too. He's very sad. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners know about this, but I know Michael Horse had a hard time participating in this particular scene. He just felt like it was just bad juju.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Yep. So I guess he's a spiritual man and he just kind of felt like he shouldn't be messing around with that kind of stuff.
Basically. Mm-hmm.
Some people take that stuff seriously. So after Leland's dead and Bob's gone to who knows where, Cooper and, well, a now very dry Cooper, Albert, and Truman follow a path. So there's some sort of indeterminate amount of time after this because everybody's dry.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like Cooper's holding a bag and he has a cup of coffee. I don't know if it's donuts in there or what, but so.
He's carrying his death bag around.
Cooper's got a death bag. And they discuss whether or not Leland was insane. Again, surprisingly, Albert comes up with insight rather than snark. Briggs is there at the path, and he kind of puts his two cents in about there being more in heaven and earth that is dreamed of in our philosophy. Then Albert suggests that Bob could be the evil that men do, which I really like. I kind of like that as a final, you know, resting place for that idea. And, you know, Truman asks finally that if it was Bob that they had, and they had him captured, and he's gotten away, where is he now? And so then we get the final scene. The episode ends with an Evil Dead 2 like scene running through your I guess ostensibly you're supposed to
be
seeing a POV
camera.
Yeah, a POV of Bob going by a car crash at the bottom of like a gully in some woods, and then it just kind of goes and goes and goes until finally it starts to come up, and then a big owl comes into the frame, and then
well, it
stops. Well,
first you see like almost like a spirit representation of the owl, and it has Bob's face on it. It's a real quick flash, and then you see the owl itself.
And then the episode's over.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's kind of self-explanatory. I guess Bob has just gone off into the woods again, you know, towards the lodge or towards something else. And we don't see too much from him for a little while. I know he comes back as part of the, you know, group of Desmonds that's in the lodge and everything. But as far as I know, it's not until the last couple of episodes that he becomes a player again. So, I don't know, maybe he's got to go off to recharge. I'm not sure.
He's got to find a host. It's weird to have Major Briggs back, though, because it almost seems like he's out of place, like he's forced into the scenes to me.
Yeah, I there was a lot of that's. I felt like a lot of this episode was forced in a way, and it didn't come out horrible. It just came out like there's some really good season two episodes that capture the essence of season one, and I think this one was really grasping for that. It was really trying to, and it just felt. You know, fell a couple inches short here and there. And that coupled with the odd angles and some of the pacing, the way they interspersed the serious and the silly, it all kind of worked to the detriment of the episode, I think.
So what I was going to say about the camera angles is that at the beginning of the episode, you have the Dutch angles, the skewed look of it. And I think it's representing people's minds are kind of... I think it's representing the discombobulation of people's emotions and
the off-kilter way that everybody's feeling.
Everybody's feeling just about the whole crime and some of the Bob stuff that they've learned about and everything, you know, especially with the details they've learned from Mike recently. And then at the end of the episode, they are no longer using the Dutch angles. It's just a regular shot, but this is specifically when they – all meet up after Leland has died and they're walking along that path. The background is actually slanted. You can see like all the trees that are behind every character is diagonal and the earth itself seems to be slanted, but they're all upright. So it's a normal shot. And I think it's to say that, you know, things are settled with them as far as, okay, we found the correct killer, but now the world as they know it is now off kilter. It's not this localized thing. It's now something that has gone even further beyond them. Like Bob got away. There's this other bigger thing that's out there, and they've, you know, they thought they had control in some sense when they had Leland, or I don't know. I mean, I feel
it
like
makes sense.
I'm
makes
trying
sense.
To make sense of the camera angles, and that's the best thing I can do with it.
At the beginning of the episode, everybody is in a bad state mentally because they're trying to find this killer of the second girl, which is actually the third girl and probably a long line of number of girls, but the third that they know, Teresa Banks being the first, Laura Palmer being the second, and now Maddie. And they're off kilter because they're just like, what the hell do we do? There's a lot of confusion at the beginning of the episode because there's a lot of talk of even Cooper says I just don't know where to start. You know, and everybody kind of has to give him these little pep talks to get him on his path and going towards, like, do what Cooper does. You know, be yourself. Be your truest form of yourself, and this will happen. Albert tells him that. Then Hawk tells him that. And later on, Philip Gerard / Mike tells him that. You know, even the giant is kind of telling them that in his own way. So he's getting all these messages, and then finally it clicks. And then at the end of the episode, all of these same guys are kind of, they've went through this sort of hell, and then, or an existentialist form of hell, and they're on the other side of it. And now they can't unlearn and they can't unsee what they've seen. So now their worldview has skewered and changed. So they're standing straight, but everything else is slanted. So I think it's actually pretty genius. I think that's what you're trying to say. I'm paraphrasing what you said. And I think it's actually genius of the director to do that. I believe it was Tim Hunter, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I saw it at the read it at the beginning of the episode, but I forgot. But it's a great move on his part. When you first watch it, before you put together the insightfulness of it and everything and kind of make it a cohesive whole like we just described, it strikes you as strange because, like our listeners have noted, usually there's a lot more subtlety and kind of, I don't want to say classic because I don't know too much about filmography, but as far as a cinematographic experience, when you're watching Twin Peaks, it flows very well. And this episode makes it kind of jagged and jangly sometimes when you're watching it. And if you're not picking up what they're putting down, so to speak, there's no real rhyme or reason to that. But then when you start to sort it out, I think it makes perfect sense.
It also, I mean, this just occurred to me, but it could be a mirror world. Like you have, it's a representation of a mirror world because at some point Cooper is going to become a host.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it happened here. And so you have one thing slanted one way at the beginning, and then at the end of the episode, it's slanted another. I know is crazy speculation, but I'm just putting that out there just in case.
It could be, but I would, just to play the devil's advocate on this, I would have to like wonder how much the writing staff knew that they were actually going to put Cooper through that experience at the end. Was this already an idea in somebody's head and it just hadn't come to fruition yet? Or like, because you've got an episode, three episodes from the end called The Road to the Black Lodge. You know what I mean? But that's episode, I think, 19 or 20. And this is episode, whatever, way back. So I don't know.
Why does the one particular dream that Laura wrote down, why does Harold make sure that Donna gets that so Cooper comes across that? Is that not part of a larger picture that eventually is going to lead Cooper down the road to the Black Lodge?
Yeah. Could be. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's just as valid as anything else.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and start into feedback, and we're going to read Joel's. We've got two emails from him, and he is first commenting on the previous podcast that we recorded. He says he wants to address one minor but crucial comment from the previous podcast about Lynch leaving season 2 to direct Wild at Heart. Lynch himself often claims this was the case, but in fact it's impossible. The film was shot in 1989, simultaneously with season 1, premiered at the Cannes Festival in May 1990, and hit U.S. theaters in August. Lynch shot his season 2 episodes from July to September and only stepped back from Twin Peaks then, so he can't use Wild at Heart as an excuse, despite his faulty memory. My take? I don't think Lynch was accustomed to or interested in weekly episodic television. Lynch is a filmmaker, and a filmmaker's job is to tell a specific story. His work ends when that story ends. Add that to his increasing attachment to Laura Palmer as a character, and you have a recipe for total disengagement with the end of her mystery. Anyway, on to episode 16. It has a lot of admirers, and I've heard many fans call it their favorite non-Lynch episode, but many others have described it as a disappointing, even anticlimactic, and end to the mystery. I'll play my cards here. I'm more in the latter camp. Cooper could have remembered Laura's clue any time, but I guess his memory and the spirits wanted to wait for sweeps month. Give me a break.
That's a really good point. When I read the letter, that's the first thing that struck me. I was like, yeah, why did it take till now? If he's had all of this, even the spirits themselves are telling him, you have everything you need. And that means he's had everything that he's needed for a little while now. Why is it that it just got to the point where he could put everything together? I mean, I know that happens in the normal course of people's actions. You know, they have all the elements of something in their head, and then it finally coalesces into that thought that really kicks everything going. Okay, sure, but is it sweeps month yet?
Do you know what that is?
Yeah, that's when they are deciding which shows are going to stick around, right?
It's
Like
ratings
based
based.
on the ratings.
Yeah, it's based on ratings. So yeah, that's when you put it like that. I mean, I wasn't aware that it was sweeps month at any point, really. I didn't understand that kind of stuff back then, and that is lame.
Yeah, because it feels forced. It feels like, okay, well, the audience already knows who killed Laura Palmer and Maddie. So now we're going to, or at least they should by this point if they're paying attention. So now we're going to reveal it to the rest of the characters on the show and just put a final capstone on the mystery when everybody's paying the most attention. So it doesn't feel as natural as it would have been, otherwise.
So Joel goes on to say, I can sort of accept the diary as a trigger. The idea of Laura helping to solve her own mystery is compelling, but using the gum as a trigger is just silly. Nobody on the show has chewed gum for 16 episodes, and now suddenly it's everywhere. The writers spend way too much time giving all the intriguing, surreal dream hints, really mundane explanations, some of which don't even make sense. Leland's hair isn't gray. You can tell they were just desperately trying to retrofit a solution. Yeah, his hair is white. The gum, though, I've been thinking it's more interesting ever since we had it was Jubel wrote us, and he was talking about how the denizens try to communicate. They try like using creamed corn
Yeah.
as a way that like childhood memories and stuff like that. So I feel like the gum could fit into that category as a way to communicate and use it as a marker, like you know.
'Cause Leland does say, I
Say.
remember that gum. I loved it when I was a kid. And then the old man says, that gum you like is gonna come back in style. So yeah, there's a bridge there between that and this. But
That seems to be the tools they use to communicate.
I don't blame Joel for having the opinion that he does, because I feel like, and I mentioned this probably three or four times in the actual recap of the episode itself, that there's a lot of reiterations and kind of callbacks and bringbacks from the golden era of Twin Peaks, from that era that, intrigued us all and got us into the show. And they're trying to kind of force it into the reality of where the show is at right now, in
Yeah,
this episode,
with really mundane explanations, as he says. Yeah.
So, I mean, it could go either way. I'm just saying there's validity to both points.
And he says, but this makes me actually like the very last scene, the one in the woods, because at least it's honest, even if it's also kind of clumsy and awkward. For once, the characters and writers are revealing their own uncertainty about what just happened. Anyway, it's a more effective gathering than the one in the roadhouse. Bobby, Leo, Big Ed. The idea is that all the players have assembled for the big climax, but it only serves to remind us how fragmented their storylines have become, sadly. And the direction doesn't work for me at all. The Dutch angles and exaggerated lighting don't fit in with the more subtle stylization the show usually employs. But I don't hate the episode. Leland's death scene, and particularly Cooper's speech, is a powerful conclusion. I agree.
Definitely.
There's also some cool stuff with Cooper's ring, which relates to his autobiography and possibly to Fire Walk With Me. More on that when we get to Coop's backstory. Overall, there are some interesting concepts at play, but the execution, both script and direction, feels like it's lacking. I imagine the nature of the Leland-Bob relationship will be a big topic this week, both on the cast and in the feedback. I'll save my thoughts on that for next time. I want to hear what others say first. I would also like to discuss the relationship between Mike, the one-armed man, and the little man, but this email is too damn long already, so I'll save them for later. Maybe as a distraction, we get to the episode with Andy's thought balloon. You know it's coming. And he's actually created his own blog about Twin Peaks, and I actually tried to share that on Facebook, and I was having some difficulty. I'm going to try to do it again and on our Twitter. But it's the dancingimage.blogspot, and I created some videos as well. So let's go on. He's got another. Did you want to comment any more on that before I move to his next letter?
The whole thing about everybody gathering into the room and having fragmented stories, I agree with that 100%. Once Laura died, and not once Laura died, but obviously she's dead before the show starts. But I mean, once Laura's mystery has been solved, these people kind of slowly fade out, and you have to find other storylines to keep them going. So whether it's Bobby or Leo or even Ben Horn, the link back to the original Laura story kind of gets tenuous at some point. And now that everything is finalized, it kind of snaps and breaks.
It ends up
So,
fragmented, as he says.
right. So it's like these people being all brought together, I kind of use it as this weird menagerie of characters. Some of these characters were there to help Cooper execute this plan that he had that wasn't really a plan. And then some of them were there because they were always potential candidates for Laura's killer, whether it was Leo, Bobby. Really, those were the only two that they really focused on at the beginning anyway. You know, and then they had Jacoby as a red herring.
And inexplicably, Big Ed.
And Big Ed falls under the category of people who are there to help, you know, even if he's only there to just help him move tables.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like they just decided, like, Everett McGill is still in this goddamn show. We need to give him a couple of minutes of screen time, you know, before he walks out on us or something. I don't know.
I just don't know why they didn't have Russ Tamblyn around more, you know? It's just...
Yeah, I know.
Joel did say he imagined that we would talk more about Leland/Bob. Do you have anything you want to say about that?
I do, but actually Daniel's feedback contains some of the stuff that I was kind of riff off of and put my own thoughts on. So okay. Joel is actually right, but we'll wait to just discuss that all together Daniel's feedback.
Okay, so his next letter, it's a PS, and he says, Joel says, PS, forgot to mention a few things real quick. Forgive me, next week's feedback will be shorter, maybe. Okay, he says, number one, cutting to Andy, Lucy, Dick in the middle of Leland Bob's meltdown is in such poor taste. It's the climax of a 17-episode mystery. Who cares about the comic relief right now? Two, on the other hand, Leland dancing with Donna is one of the creepiest and most effective horror scenes, in part because it feels more domestic violence than Demon from In the Woods. Three, Cooper's trick to get Leland to the station is, to me, one of the entire show's most ludicrous conceits. Even assuming that Bob is in total control, he's been in the world for at least 40 years. Is he really supposed to have no idea that a father would not defend his daughter's alleged killer? And why does nobody else react? They don't know about Bob being in Leland, yet they just take it in stride. At least a baffled reaction or two would have been nice. And that's what I was saying. Like, why, when Cooper, you know, whispers into Harry's ear, the look on Harry's face does not really reflect what I would imagine he would respond with. He almost has this, he squints his eyes in response, like he's going, instead of widening his eyes in shock, you know, and then, you know, toeing the line. But
it's one of those things where, you know, those movies that you watch sometimes and they have this twist at the end. And you, the first time you watch it, you're just not seeing it coming at all. And then when the twist happens, you're like, oh my God, that's so awesome. You know, the kid was fucking dead the whole time. That's great. You know, whatever the movie happens to be and whatever the twist happens to be. Then you go and you watch the movie again and you're like, all right, this isn't holding up under scrutiny. This person would have known this and this person would have known that. And there's no way this character would have reacted to that character in this fashion, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what's happening is they're trying to, the writers were trying to make it to where there was nothing at all that would get that they were basing the gut punch of this episode, besides Leland's death, being when they push Leland into the cell. That was the big center point of the physical action in this whole episode. And they wanted to like make that as unpredictable as possible. And so I think they had to make sure that all of the other characters, as unbelievable as this might be to us, all of their reactions had to be so subtle that we wouldn't get a hint that something like that was coming. And that's a shitty explanation for that, but I feel like that's what they were doing.
That's probably what it is. Yeah. And so then and his last point, he says, to not end in an entirely negative note, I've been looking at some images from the episode and feel I was a bit too harsh on director Tim Hunter. I still don't like the skewed angles, but there are some really cool visuals here, like the ring dropping and Coop picking it up, or the dissolves between the dream sequence and Donna's lips.
There's definitely some beautiful cinematography going on here. If you were to watch this episode with the sound turned off, I mean, I think the average hardcore Twin Peaks fan would get a lot more out of it. You know, that might actually be worth doing sometime, just have a little bourbon and just watch this episode without the sound on. You know, maybe play the soundtrack in the background or something, because I don't have a problem with the angles and things like that. It's just it was a weird choice to have it so heavily concentrated in this episode when so much important stuff is being revealed to the audience.
Next, we have feedback from Daniel. He starts talking about the episode. He says, while there are great parts in this one, I feel like some of the mechanics is in such an important milestone weren't handled well, and so the episode falls a little flat for me, but lots to talk about. The letter O under Maddie's fingernail, Teresa's was T, Laura's was R, and A B was put under Braunettes. I think Bob was spelling Robert backwards, just like how the lodge spirits speak, which has to do with the way time flows there. But in that case, where is the victim with an E under their fingernail? Might that dead girl turn up someday? Yeah, I never realized it was backwards. And yeah, good point. Where's the E?
I
If
never
that's the
realized it
case.
was backwards either, and that makes perfect sense because that is how those spirits talk back. So it's a no-brainer when you think about it now, but it took somebody to point it out to us. Thank you. But I guess the E under the finger is probably going to be the catalyst for having a season 3 in the first place, because there's got to be another dead girl, right? At least I'm assuming.
Yeah, it's interesting because he says that's the way time flows there. So is it folded time? Because anyway, it's a mind fuck.
Yeah.
That's a mind fuck. But that's interesting because you do have.
I can't really speak to the fact that that's how time flows there, because I don't know yes or no to that answer. I'll go with that for sure. But I do know that that's the way that they communicate.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So we now see that Mrs. Tremond wasn't the real Mrs. Tremond at all, which again does make me wonder what their purpose was for revealing themselves to Donna. I wonder that too, Daniel. Was Harold protected from them inside his house, so they used her to get in and torment him? There is an interesting callback to this in the film. Cooper is drawn to the spot where we saw Agent Desmond look under a trailer and find the green ring, only there is no trailer anymore. The manager says an old woman and her grandson lived there and their name was Chalfont. But actually, Chalfont was also the name of the people that had lived in that space before. So what I think the old woman and the grandson do is materialize in a physical reality and subsume whatever and whoever is there, even taking the names of the people in that space as their own Chalfont Tremond in order to do their work before vanishing once again without a trace.
So this is the actual Tremond lady who's left here.
Mm-hmm.
So people would think that, yeah, there was Tremonts who lived here before, and then there's Tremonts who live here now, or a Tremont, just like with the Chalfonts and the trailer. It's interesting.
I think he's saying that they somehow inhabit that space, even though the real Tremont lives there.
So they're there simultaneously.
Right.
Okay.
That's what I'm gathering from what he's saying.
Yeah, it's a...
He says they materialize in a physical reality and subsume whatever and whoever is there, even taking the names of the people in that space as their own before vanishing once again without a trace.
It's tough to say because it's one of those things that theory sounds as good as anything that I could come up with.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to agree with it, honestly, because if only for the fact that, I mean, I do think it sounds good, but if only for the fact that I can't think of anything better, goddammit. Yeah.
Well, it has to be that. I mean, that woman looks like she'd been living there
forever. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like we could see her whole house, but it looked from what we could see,
mm-hmm.
our vantage point through the door, like it was a well lived in place.
Yeah.
Right?
Somebody didn't just move into there.
Yeah.
And I mean, she was there. Donna was there.
Were those sunglasses she was wearing?
Yes,
indoors?
They were. Donna was there a few days before delivering, you know, the cream corn and chicken and everything to the Tremonds. And then, you know, Harold kills himself a few days later, and then she was there. She was living there to get the note, you know, that was addressed to Donna. So she had to have been there for the whole time. So the theory has to be correct, really.
So Daniel says, I think it's cool how Laura had the same dream as Cooper, and another example how time works differently in the world of the Lodge. This is also the first indication we get that Laura was not just a victim, she was a hero. She chose death over letting Bob transfer to her and becoming an abuser herself at a test her father failed. Yes, I agree. It's
definitely, yeah. Laura was too strong for that.
That's what redeems Laura and makes her story even more sad and more interesting.
Do you think that that's why she was so cruel to James, was to try to push him away?
That's why she was cruel to a lot of people.
Yeah,
I think, you know, for multiple reasons. Even Dr. Jacoby's insight about why she was cruel to people, I think, is also true, along with the fact she wanted to push people away.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess he's referring to me. He says, and when you mentioned your theory that Cooper might be Mike's true face, I got excited because I have a similar theory. I think Mike might be grooming Cooper to become his next host. In this episode, it looks like Philip Gerard is deteriorating as a viable host, and we never see him again after this. The spirit Mike seems to have fondness for Cooper, even touches him affectionately, and at the end laments so much responsibility. If this theory holds, it would add a new perspective to the final episode, a contest between Mike, represented by the little man, and Bob over who will take Cooper for their own. And as we know, Bob emerges the victor. Also, Mike calls his and Bob's partnership a golden circle of appetite and satisfaction. Do you think this was represented by the gold band of the ring in the film?
We've got a phone here. It's got a little ring to it.
That's interesting. Yeah, so you took, I threw that out there feeling kind of, you know, wildly speculative and almost embarrassed by it. So I'm glad that you got excited by me throwing that out there. And but of course, you have a much more fleshed out theory here, Daniel. I'm just going to have to like pay more attention as we go on, and I will comment on this again. Right now, I'm not sure what I think. But you're right, he was being very affectionate towards Cooper. I noticed the way he kind of was reaching his hand toward Cooper and touching him.
If you notice, the lore of Twin Peaks moves past Laura Palmer and that sort of thing, and it moves towards the lodge and the owls and the space transmissions and all of the stuff that Briggs was involved in and everything. I forgot the name of the project that they were doing. Wasn't there a secret project? At any rate,
Project Blue Book.
Blue Book. Okay, yeah. Which generally gets identified with aliens, right? But that makes sense because we're dealing with. But anyway, all of that lore is what Twin Peaks started to move towards when it was on its mystic side of things, and it was away from the whole Laura Palmer stuff. And that would kind of be a really good story to tell, you know, because Leland's gone. So now Bob has to find a new host, and Philip Gerard is never seen from again. So we can assume that he just died there in the lot, you know, at the Great Northern, or who knows what happened to him. But if he's not seen again, we don't even really have to speculate on it. It's not an issue anymore. So you have these two inhabiting spirits who need to inhabit something, and they're both vying for the same, because they're rivals and they're enemies now when they used to be friends. They're both vying for the same body. So that's actually a really solid theory. I wouldn't be surprised at all if that was, you know, those threads were picked up on, you know, when Twin Peaks starts again.
It hasn't really been revealed how they actually enter their host body. So how does that happen?
Well, if that's purposely left vague and nebulous, then, I mean, it's all the more reason to think that this could be a viable story option.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on. Daniel says, I really like the scene with Leland and Donna. Ray Wise does a great job of being menacing, and the sound design is pure dread. When Leland suddenly grabs her and Donna breaks down crying as she leaves the house, do you think that she finally realizes the trauma her best friend lived with, or even who killed her? I wish Leland had killed her and spared us a few bad plot lines.
Snap.
Oh, wow.
Well, Daniel, that's we definitely would have been spared some bad stuff. I mean, but if we're going to get to that, why couldn't he have killed Nadine or you know, Bobby's friend Mike, or, you know, just somebody along those lines? But you're right. It would have spared us some bad scenes. To be serious, though, and answer the question, it is a really menacing scene. And I hadn't thought of that upon initially watching it or even the second time. But after reading the feedback, it does kind of make you wonder if she's a lot more sympathetic now to, like, what Laura had gone through, like what her home life might have been. And because she's not thinking this guy's possessed by Bob, she's just thinking to herself, God, this dude was Laura's dad and he's a fucking creep right now. You know, he's grabbing me, he's trying to dance with me. I mean, I know he's still in the grip of grief and everything, but that's just, oof.
I'm going to say that I don't think she realizes that he killed Laura. I think she would have had a more visceral reaction about her own safety.
Yeah.
The brush with death that she just had. I think she would have realized that, and she probably, I mean, when she goes and meets with James, it was to me more to reveal that she knows that Maddie's dead.
That's what I was going to bring up. I think maybe later on when she digests everything and it has a chance to settle, she might kind of start to feel something like that, like in the back of her mind. She might start to kind of feel a little bit more of an understanding of what Laura had went through. I think that's a valid point. But at that time, and then directly afterwards when she leaves and she's walking to meet James at the park, I think really all that's on her mind is A, what happened to Maddie, and B, what's going to happen with her relationship with James. So I think in her adult mind, in the back of it somewhere, there's probably that thought process kind of in a nascent form, but in her teenage mind, she's worried about those two things.
You know what? I don't remember the plot lines that Dawn is in from this point on out.
Well, I
But
know she is part of James's plot line, his really bad plot line towards the end of
I
it.
know she goes and hunts him down, she finds him, and she helps him out of the situation. I remember that.
And I think there's some gunplay and he gets shot or something, or almost gets shot, or
That does not sound familiar.
somebody gets shot in that scene. I think it might be the lady that he's sleeping with shoots her husband before he has a chance to shoot
Her
James
partner,
or her
or
partner,
whoever you, yeah.
whatever it is. It doesn't make it any better, that's for sure.
Okay, the roadhouse. Okay, so Daniel says the roadhouse scene feels rushed and forced, with many peripheral characters present who sadly no longer have anything to do with the mystery. Though I do kind of like the idea that Laura solves her own mystery, if it were implemented better. The idea that Leland would calmly represent the man being charged with murdering his own daughter is absurd, and I absolutely hate Cooper's script interpreting the elements of his dream as overly literal clues to the plot. Leland's hair turned white, not gray. This is interesting that they're making some of the similar points here. And the little man still dances later when it has nothing to do with Leland. And he's got one more paragraph. I just don't know if you wanted to comment on that before I move on.
Yeah, see, this is some of the similarity that's, between both of them. They bring up how Leland wouldn't be, the real Leland wouldn't be hot to trot to be Ben Horn's lawyer if he's being charged with murdering his daughter. But this is the guy who doesn't know the difference between orange juice and, whatever lemonade. You know what I mean? Whatever it was he said he was going to serve Donna, which was the lemonade and orange juice or whatever. Well, he goes, I know exactly what you need. I'm going to go get you some lemonade, kid. And he comes back with Sunny D, And so by that, I don't want to put too much emphasis on that scene and say, okay, this is an indicator of Bob's personality or anything like that. But it does tell me that what's paramount in his mind is not the contradiction of him being the lawyer of the person who murdered his child. It's making sure that everybody is fooled and keeping appearances. So Cooper puts it out there. This is what I think is happening. Cooper puts it out there that this is what's expected of him, and Bob follows along. Because, yeah, he's been inhabiting this person's body for 40 years, but he's still an alien in this world. It's not his natural state. It's not his natural element. So he still takes cues from other people, and this is the one guy he's trying to fool. This is the big bad lawman. He's really only afraid of Mike, at least according to Laura, but I'm sure he's wary of Cooper. So it's kind of like, well, okay, Cooper wants me to be the lawyer, so I'm going to be the lawyer because that's the key to getting out of this situation with everything intact. And so that's what he goes with. But it is a glaring kind of thing because in a normal circuit, really it's not so much what Bob is doing, it's why isn't all of the other people in the room having more reaction to it? Kind of like what Joel said, like why isn't everybody else going, what the fuck are you talking about? Why would you be his lawyer?
Yeah, I know, or even making faces at the idea, at least.
Maybe that's what that moment is like after all the important people who are part of that scene at the Roadhouse leave, and you've got Bobby, Leo, Daddy Briggs, and Ed all standing there, and they're just kind of looking off into the distance. Maybe that's the WTF moment that we're all looking for. They're just like, it looked like a class photo or something, or a field trip photo, but maybe that's supposed to convey the blank look on their faces, like, what did we just see?
And Daniel says he hates Cooper's script interpreting the elements of his dream as overly literal. And I felt like it's kind of like disappointment because you're hoping that it's going to open up something else even bigger. It was like a tip of an iceberg to something else, and it's just boring. So now his final paragraph, he says, finally, at the end, Leland is presented very much as an innocent victim of a demon. When Lynch goes into this world again, to the film Fire Walk With Me, he will very deliberately subvert this easier interpretation and go out of his way to blur the line between Bob and Leland for us. I think for the sake of real life abuse victims, this is best, as indulging the devil made me do it would just feel wrong to me. There's more to say on this for the film, though.
This is the point where I wanted to save the conversation that Joel had brought up about the relationship between Leland and Bob, because there is a ton of stuff to say about that. But I wanted to wait until, so I wasn't reiterating and saying it twice or whatever. But there is very much a difference in tone between this episode and Fire Walk With Me in regards to how we look at the relationship of who did what and how much culpability can be put on Leland Palmer and how much on Bob. And I think if you look at the two, it's kind of like I mean, one of them's an R-rated movie. Another one was a primetime television show. So you're going to have a PG version, and then you're going to have a movie version. In the PG TV version, you get the easy-to-digest narrative that the devil made me do it, and I was an innocent victim. In the movie version, we get a lot more nuanced, complicated look at domestic abuse, and we see that this wasn't just this. This was also an inherent part of Leland Palmer's personality, as ugly and disgusting as it was. There was something there. There was a blurred line between what Leland was doing and what Bob was making Leland do. And I think that probably speaks more to the reality of people that I would assume this has never happened to me, thankfully, but to, people who have been abused in that way, this would probably speak more to the reality of that. So, but then, I also kind of take a devil's advocate look at this too, not to overuse the devil theme here, but this is how, David Lynch wasn't part of this episode. He wasn't part of the writing or the directing or anything. So you could kind of say, on one hand, that Fire Walk With Me is his version of how the relationship between Leland and Bob actually took place, and this is Mark Frost's version right here. The TV version is Mark Frost's version of Leland and Bob's relationship. Fire Walk With Me is David Lynch's version of Leland and Bob's relationship. One of them is, like I said, PG television, and the other one is an R-rated movie. They're very, very different. And I would, if David Lynch had had something to do with that episode, or if Mark Frost had had something to do with the writing of the movie, I would kind of call the bullshit card and say that it's revisionist history, and saying, okay, well, now we can make a movie, so we can make it dark and nasty and horrifying, whereas the TV show had to be keep it under a certain dark tone. And now they can just go hog wild. I don't think that's that at all. I think it's two different writers' interpretations of this particular relationship. So hopefully that answers both Joel and Daniel's question about the relationship between, Leland and Bob. That's what I think about it.
Yeah, I don't have anything more to add to that. I'm, I guess I
You
agree.
know, and Cooper says something too, because when they're all sitting there outside and they're in their dry clothes and they're talking about what just happened. And Truman expresses disbelief at the fact that this could have, that Leland could have been possessed. He was probably just crazy. And then Cooper kind of says something that's a little hard hitting. He says, well, Harry, is it easier to believe that a father would rape and murder his own daughter? Does that make it better? And he's like, no, it doesn't. So I think that right there gives us Frost's take on it, because he's putting it all on Bob at the time, because the alternative is to say that
Worse.
Leland was an incestuous rapist and a murderer. And now, you know what I mean? But then when we get the story handed off back to Lynch and he does the movie, we get a very different take on it. So, which it kind of runs the gamut for the viewer, and it's a nice thing, and it leaves it up to us as the viewer to decide which interpretation we really take to heart. But I know myself, I tend to favor the Fire Walk With Me portrayal of things, because it I think it's more well done, and it's more realistic and it's better thought out, I believe.
I don't know if I like one or the other better. I kind of wish both of them jive together a little bit more. So that's all I have to say on this episode.
That's it for me.
So Albert's dad is Shaddam the Fourth. He should tell Count Fenrig hi. I mean,
Bene Gesserit witch must leave.
I'm desperately weaving this Dune thread throughout this.
Well, there's this is a David Lynch project. There's
Yeah.
Lynch mob members here. I mean, we've got Kyle MacLachlan, we've got Everett McGill, we've got Jack Nance. Who else was in Dune? Is that the only three people that were in Dune? Not
David
the
Lynch.
David Lynch himself.
Yep.
That's four. Not that this is really terribly important, but I can't think of too many other people. Josie Packard, she was a Fremen.
She was
Kidding, I'm
not.
totally kidding. I think Harry Truman was a guild steersman, and then
Piper Laurie would have been great as a Bene Gesserit.
yeah.
But she was not, but she would have. All right, I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it
Like
is.
it sounds.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.